This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's an in-studio conversation with New York Times chief Washington correspondent and ISU alum, Carl Hulse.
The State Department, for instance, being hollowed out, you know, a big arm of the United States government that's been powerful for a long time is really suffering.
Hulse talks about the change Trump has brought to Washington, and he'll answer questions about fake news. Hear about a Supreme Court case regarding the use of police deadly force. Protests continue in St. Louis following the acquittal of a white officer in the shooting of a black suspect. And it's a conversation with ISU President Larry Dietz. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's September 18th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from country financial representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Normal's three movie theater chains aren't just waiting around for the movies to get better. They're spending big on renovations, adding customer loyalty programs, and scheduling shows that aren't even movies. This increased competition locally is part of a larger problem facing theaters: how to stay relevant in the age of Netflix. GLT's Ryan Denham examines the changing movie marketplace in Bloomington Normal.
I don't know about you, but the one thing I never want to change in Bloomington Normal movie theaters is the creepy whispering guy who you can hear before the show starts at the old Werenberg Theaters on Bloomington's west side. And here's some good news. Even after Marcus Theaters bought and took over the theater last winter, the whispering remains.
Hi, I'm Greg Marcus, third generation CEO of the Marcus Corporation, and we're thrilled that our family of theaters now includes Werenberg. Together, we have over 180 years of experience providing the magic of movies. In fact, we still operate the very first theater my grandfather opened in Ripon, Wisconsin.
With Marcus buying Werenberg, that means all three Bloomington Normal multiplexes now have different owners than they did 2 years ago. Starplex Cinemas in North Normal was bought by AMC, and in a related deal, a new company called New Vision Theaters acquired the Ovation Cinema Grill Dinner Theater in Far East Bloomington. One of the first things Marcus did with Werenberg was renovation. They're installing super comfy recliner seating in addition to $5 discount days on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Here's Marcus Theater's chairman, president, and CEO, Rolando Rodriguez.
I can tell you it's well into the millions of dollars. These are major investments that we make, and we make them to obviously make sure that the price-value relationship and the type of experience that we provide the consumers are in line with what their expectations are. And so, look, we are big believers in this industry. We're big believers in providing the best experience possible. We are a company that's been around for 82 years ourselves in the theater business, and we hope to be around another 80. And the way to do that is you need to make sure that you're constantly changing and evolving and understanding your consumer better than you did the day before.
Before Marcus did it, reserve seating and comfy seats was kind of Ovation Cinema Grill's thing. That's a theater on Bloomington's east side that has waiters and waitresses who bring you beer and popcorn. New Vision bought that theater in April, one of 17 theaters in 9 states that regulators said had to be sold as part of AMC's acquisition of rival Carmike. Looking to keep up with the competition, New Vision has experimented with a date night package, $5 discount Tuesdays, and they'll be rolling out a moviegoers rewards program this fall. John Halecki from New Vision says they're putting a greater emphasis on food and beverage since taking over the theater.
We have been introducing, as we are a number of our theaters, some local options, whether they be beverage options from local breweries or favorite foods that are indigenous to a particular area. These changes will continue, but on the food and beverage side, but also in some of the programming that happens at the theater.
These ownership changes and consolidations are a trend in the industry, says Jeff Bach, senior box office analyst at Exhibitor Relations in Los Angeles. He says it's tough for smaller theaters and chains to survive on their own as studios make deals with the bigger theaters, also called circuits. Popcorn is no longer enough.
everything is turning into a multiplex, or like you said, an event destination, like a that offers dinner and a movie at the same place, or at least beer, wine, alcohol, and tapas or fancy food, and that's the way the entire business is going, from coast to coast. So it sounds like what you have there is a microcosm of what's going on everywhere in North America cinemas right now.
The summer box office was down 16% below last year. The biggest culprit were sequels that flopped, like Pirates of the Caribbean 5 or Transformers 5. Only three of them made more than their predecessors, which is rare. Bach, the box office expert, says it's all about quality.
People will come if you build a product that they actually want to come and see. And that's the problem that we, I think, ran into this summer, that there wasn't a whole lot of films out there that necessitated, casual audiences to leave the confines of their comfy homes and $9.99 a month services. That's really the key of what's going on in the industry right now, and something that Hollywood, has to grapple with. Yes, right now the quality of what's on Netflix and HBO and Amazon is far superior week in and week out to what's in theaters. That is something that Hollywood has to directly combat against, and it comes down to, making better movies. And as far as, smaller theaters are concerned, that's their lifeblood. They need to have films that not only get good critical response, but that audiences actually want to see.
Rolando Rodriguez from Marcus Theaters agrees. He points to the recent success of Stephen King's adaptation, It, as a bright spot, a rare case of Hollywood delivering something audiences want to see on the big screen.
Bill, if you will come with me, we'll float too.
George.
We wish that some of the films were better than what they were. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it comes down to. If you, it's not a question that the industry's in trouble. It's not a question that the theaters are in trouble. It's a question of, is the proper types of films and the proper type of entertaining films are being introduced to the marketplace. And when they are, clearly the consumer reacts and appreciates that this is an entertainment option that they want to pursue.
People just don't go to the movies as much as they used to. And I don't just mean now versus the 1950s, when there wasn't much else to do. The trend line on moviegoers in the U.S. and Canada is on a downward trajectory. Admissions peaked in 2002, with admissions of more than 1.5 billion moviegoers. It fell to 1.3 billion last year. To insulate themselves from Hollywood flops and draw in new customers, local theaters are looking beyond big studio new releases. On a recent weekend, the list of movies at Marcus Werenberg, for example, included several Indian films, plus re-releases like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Rodriguez says that's a relatively new development, and that his company is driven by consumer demand. They even showed the recent McGregor-Mayweather fight on the big screen.
We're starting to really gain some traction and understanding by the consumer that, boy, we can catch some other alternative type of programming that could be very exciting. It's not just the Indian audience. There's obviously a Hispanic audience out there. There's an African-American audience. And you're seeing that Hollywood is obviously recognizing that some of these consumers play a bigger and bigger role into the ticket sales that we're driving. I'll give you one brief example. The Hispanics actually represent 23% of the ticket sales within our industry. That's a pretty significant, piece of business, and hopefully one to understand, both on how we market, how we communicate, and the type of films that are obviously very attractive to them.
Across town at New Vision's Ovation Cinema Grill, they're scheduling more and more one-time-only screenings targeting niche audiences, like opera performances. Here's John Halecki from New Vision.
You can see a mainstream movie at any mainstream theater. Some of our larger national competitors are so large that it's to be nimble. And we've had a focus as a new company trying to cultivate we call cinema events, which would be one performance only or limited engagements of movies that might be obscure, might be foreign, might be a little bit arty, but also live events that might not otherwise be available to people in the area, such as Broadway shows that are filmed in HD and then into the theaters.
All these programming changes have caught the eye of Adam Fox, the manager of the Normal Theater, the historic art house cinema in Uptown Normal. But he tells GLT's Laura Kennedy that he welcomes any increased exposure for good film in the community. His theater, after all, has one screen and can only show so many movies each year.
The changes in leadership at all of the different multiplexes in town affect us a bit because there's different philosophies behind some of those organizations. AMC has always been very supportive of independent film and art house film. AMC River East is the host of the Chicago Independent Film Festival, for instance. So some of those titles in the kind of art house circuit that we show and we love to be able to share with the community is something that AMC would also potentially be very interested in. And while we haven't seen that happen yet out at the former Starplex, there is certainly something I'm aware of that possibility that they could start doing that. That said, a lot of what they show, the major AAA releases, the big budget Hollywood films, are not the things that we're going to have on our screen, or at least not for another 10 or 15 years. And we can then throw it as a, you know, throwback cult classic kind of thing. So we actually have a very amicable relationship with all of those different places. We love that they're showing the films they show. We show the films we show. And all of us together are getting people out of their house. We're getting them off the couch, getting them out to there to support going to see a film in the cinema, which is so important.
For moviegoers, the bad news is tickets at the multiplexes aren't likely to get cheaper anytime soon, barring discount days and other one-offs. A decade ago, the average ticket price in the U.S. and Canada was $6.55. Now it's $8.65. Box office expert Jeff Bach says it's always ticking up and up.
On a yearly basis, you're seeing it go up every time, and part of that is probably, you know, a lot of the investment that AMC and other theaters have done, you know, that call for an increase in ticket price. You know, barely a year goes by in Los Angeles where we don't see, even at my local theater here, it goes up. It seems like every right at the start of summer, you know, whatever that big movie is, the first of the summer, they add an extra quarter, an extra 50 cents per ticket.
The theater chains say Bloomington Normal remains a good market for them, in part because it's a college town filled with moviegoers interested in both blockbusters and off-the-beaten-path films. There's also some disposable income and a reasonably diverse population that's led to the Indian films popping up. John Halecki from New Vision says the bad box office summer is all about the studios and their biggest movies. For theaters like his, the real story is what they can do to make getting out of the house an attractive option.
Going to the theater, going somewhere else out of your home and being entertained on something other than a 4.5-inch diagonal screen on a smartphone is something inherent in the nature of humans. You know, in the 1900s, they didn't have movie theaters, but people went to coffee houses. Since then, there have been one thing after another that are reasons to get out of the house. And the greatest cure for cabin fever is a two-hour vacation at a movie theater.
I'm Ryan Denon.
Tomorrow on GLT Sound Ideas, get a preview of the Normal Theater's next installment of the six-week film school series called From Alice to Silence, the Scorsese style. You're listening to the Bernard Herrmann score to Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver on Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, hear about the early heat in the Illinois AG race now that current Attorney General Lisa Madigan has announced she's not seeking another term. The IPR Politics Roundtable is on the way. I'm Mike McCurdy. Ameren, Illinois is planning a 10-mile high-voltage transmission line from near Hudson to Normal. It's part of the company's $45 million project to modernize transmission systems in McLean County. WGLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Ameren project manager Jamie Stone, who says the company wants residents to tell them how construction will affect their land.
The McLean County Reliability Project is proposed to ensure reliability and modernize the transmission system by way of a 10-mile line in McLean County from the existing McLean County substation to the new Hershey substation.
Define increased reliability for listeners, would you? What exactly does that mean compared to what they have now, which is not bad?
Increased reliability basically means that, I'm going to use the highway analogy here. So we have a highway and you want to get from point A to point B, but due to road construction, maybe a road damage, something like that, you can't get all the way to your point B. So now we're going to provide, rather than using small side roads to take a lot longer to get there, we're going to provide an extra highway. Now you can go around whatever the obstruction is, and you can get there and ensure that whenever that highway is closed down, that you'll still be able to get to where you need to go.
What's it going to look like for people who are driving by or who may see something going by their yard?
It's a steel monopole is the technical term that we use for the construction. It's a tall steel pole on a concrete foundation with wire, so it's got less footprint, less visibility as far as the horizon compared to existing large lattice structures.
Compare it to those older existing large lattice structures. What's the difference in footprint and what's the difference in aesthetics?
I would say at its largest, a steel monopole foundation could be around 10 foot in diameter. So it's a fairly small footprint compared to a lattice structure, which has four legs. The square can range anywhere, I imagine, from a 20-foot square up to several hundred feet, depending on the size of that tower. And then we have wood pole construction that you see that's usually two wood poles. So now you have two poles and sometimes guy wires that you're trying to farm around. And the steel monopole is just that one 10-foot circle, so you can cattle can graze or you can grow agriculture right up to the foundation.
Do you prefer to go a rural route or an urban route along a major arterial like Rab Road? What are the trade-offs in deciding a particular route?
We use four criteria for deciding a route: opportunities, sensitivities, technical guidelines, and regulations. So opportunities would be existing corridors that already have some sort of utility there, maybe existing easements. And then sensitivities are to avoid people's homes, daycares, churches, farmland, watersheds, things of that nature. Then we have to look at also being cost effective and using so that we can build it from a technical standpoint and still be cost effective.
Let me return to the reliability issue. Give me a better sense of how much more reliable it will be in terms of expected flickers per year or per 5 years or brownout capacity and under peak usage. Or what are the metrics you use?
Ameren generally takes a proactive standpoint in doing studies of those of that kind of nature from, like I said, earlier was 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road. So growth doesn't always look the same as expansion throughout the entire county, but it could be other growths like electric vehicles or things that aren't necessarily expanding by footprint, but expanding by power load. So in order to be there down the road when it's needed, this redundancy would satisfy that for this particular area on that Bloomington Normal northeast kind of corner.
Growth in this urban area has slowed over the last 5, 6, 7 years. What are you projecting for growth in power demand?
I don't know the exact numbers from our studies. It will be included in our testimony, but I don't know what the exact numbers were, but they were positive over, have been for the past 12 years and continue to show positive over the next 5 to 10.
Are there societal trends that will either increase the need or mitigate the need, such as increased use of electric cars or increased use of home generation through solar power?
I can't speak to how much solar usage is going to happen. I can't predict that in the area, so I don't know how much that would retract from the grid, but we do see electric vehicles and otherwise they call smart growth, which may be growing up rather than out, and that's what we're basing our studies on.
So smart growth is part of the case for this project?
Correct.
What do you want to know from the public?
I want to know where their pinch points are and where their pain points are. So where we've drawn segments to indicate to the public that have potential to be a route down the road, if there's something there that we can't gain just from maps and geographical data. So I want their input. I want them to also know that we're listening to their input so that we can make the best decision on a route.
The map of potential route segments looks like a grid, but in terms of drawing a straight line from northwest to southeast in Hudson Township to Rab and Hershey, a hypotenuse of the triangle would be the least throw for you. How much difference does it directness make in cost?
Obviously, the shortest line would be the least expensive line from just the construction of the line standpoint. But to cross several farms on a diagonal would probably prove to be more expensive than the line construction would be decreased. So we would be not only upsetting landowners that now have a line going right through the middle of their farm, but agreements with the Farm Bureau and other such entities don't really encourage that sort of routing.
When you get input from the public, you're going to develop how many preferred routes or alternative routes, and then how do you go forward with the Illinois Commerce Commission in the approval process?
So I've been using the term whittle it down, so we'll whittle down this segments, the sort of grid, down to what look like paths and get further input. And then at that point, we look to have two defined routes by the end of the year. Those are what we will submit to the ICC sort of as a primary and alternative. At that point, the ICC has final ruling to select one or the other or a combination of the two in order to fulfill the certificate.
It's a $45 million project. What's it going to cost people?
It should cost people roughly 18 cents a month on their energy bill.
Over what period?
Over the life of the asset.
How long is the asset going to live in an accounting sense?
In an accounting sense, roughly 60 years.
So that's 18 cents per month, so it's about $1.50 per year. And do local ratepayers pay that, or everyone in the Ameren territories?
Ameren, Illinois customers throughout the state.
We had talked about it being a single shaft steel pole. 75 to 130 feet tall is typical. How deep underground does it go?
Foundations average 25 to 35 feet deep.
Do you yank the pillars and pylons, or at the end of its useful life, whenever that might be, it could be a lot longer than 60 years, do you tear it out of the ground and restore it, or what happens?
Currently, as we replace aging infrastructure in other areas, we remove the existing and rebuild or install new.
And how often do you have to install new as opposed to reuse with a little tweaking?
This sort of construction has not reached the end of its life in our area at this point in time. So currently, we would be talking about wood structures that have reached the end of their life that we're replacing with a more robust structure, such as the steel shaft.
People love their trees. What's the impact on forestation of this route, this line?
Hopefully none, but there are very few trees in the area. There is a clearance. Well, we request a 100-foot wide easement, and that's driven to keep vegetation out of the transmission lines. So there would be trimming needed in that easement if there is vegetation that grows upward. Conductor clearance is a code minimum, 21 feet from the ground to the bottom of the sag on the conductor or the wire. So the code dictates that we need to be at a minimum of 21 feet, but we design as needed depending upon the topography of the area.
How much difference are the newer style of pole going to make for farmers?
So they should retain the same land use that they have at this time. They can farm and allow their cattle to graze right up to the foundation, and then all of their farm equipment, including pivot sprayers and aerial dust, crop dusting, all of those things will still be able to happen as they do today.
Ameren Project Manager Jamie Stone talking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Once a route is chosen, Ameren, Illinois will negotiate with landowners over the price of an easement. Public comment sessions will be held October 19th at the Radisson Hotel and November 14th at the Illinois State University Alumni Center. The project goes to the Illinois Commerce Commission for approval in February. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy, a couple of weeks ago, the race for attorney general was on nobody's radar. Everyone thought incumbent Lisa Madigan was secure and comfortable in that job, with high popularity ratings and even bipartisan approval of the job she's been doing. Then Madigan said she would not run for another term. That's the topic of this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable. Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, Bernie Schoenberg of the State Journal Register, and Rick Pearson, the political writer for the Chicago Tribune, are this week's panelists, moderated by Sean Crawford. Bernie Schoenberg says the announcement let loose a lot of pent-up demand for higher office.
You know, one of the people that almost immediately named herself as interested as Elaine Nekritz, who had been a longtime legislator from Northbrook, north of Chicago. She's a Democrat and left the legislature in part clearly because of the frustration of getting things done in a legislature with a lot of deadlocks. So she threw her name in. State Senator Kwame Raoul had talked in the past about wanting to be attorney general when everybody thought Lisa Madigan was going to run for governor 4 years ago. She then pulled herself out of that. So Senator Raoul step forward. There was immediate speculation what happens to Erica Harold, who ran for in a primary for Congress a few years ago against Rodney Davis in Central Illinois and lost as a Republican, but she's a practicing attorney in Urbana. She is the 2003 Miss America, which gives her a little immediate note. She's been involved in, prison reform kind of issues or help to people behind bars in getting their lives together. And she's a Harvard law graduate, so she has a lot of credentials. There was some thought the Republicans might look for somebody else, but clearly late in the week, I think it was 45 state legislators were named on a list of people endorsing her. So clearly the party is getting behind her.
And one of those was Jim Durkin. His name had floated as somebody who might run.
Yeah. This is, you know, unlike many other offices in Illinois, you do have to be an attorney to be attorney general. And so lots of people with that credential are looking at it. And it will be rather interesting to see if there's a Democrat primary or if anybody challenges Erica Harold on the Republican side.
And Rick, I guess when it comes to Lisa Madigan, the question had been, why now? Why make this decision? It seems as though a lot of folks aren't necessarily buying that she just says she wants to move on to some other challenges. In fact, there had been thought that she might try to run for mayor of Chicago down the road. What are you hearing up there regarding her political future, if there is one?
Well, I think obviously the timing is what struck everybody because a few weeks earlier, she had representatives attending the Cook County Democratic slate making, urging support for her reelection. Petitions were out. There was no reason to think that she wasn't going to be the candidate. A lot of speculation, not necessarily people who were in the know, about just the fact that there might be a job offer in the private sector out there. That, with two young children, time to go make some money in the private sector, that her father still staying in as the longest serving House Speaker, effectively blocking her political future. She disdained the idea that she would run against Rahm Emanuel next year, not interested in governor. Her political career has always been somewhat of a conundrum because, she starts out in the state Senate, moves to attorney general, no doubt enjoys an executive office more than a necessarily legislative one, even though her name had been floated out there as a potential U.S. Senate candidate at some point. And so I think, quite frankly, if anything, it's probably more of a time out to make some money, and she'll be back.
Charlie, are you surprised to see this type of, people usually don't take these time off, or time outs, I guess you would say, from politics in Illinois. And if they do, it's usually not on their own volition. And here she's done it. Did it surprise you to see her not run again, or did you kind of understand the reasoning?
Well, it surprised me that she's not running again, but I can understand why she may want to, as we say, take a time out. As you mentioned, she has young children. I think at least one of them is getting on to preteen or adolescent years. Maybe she wants to spend more time with her kids, which would be very understandable to someone who's a parent or a grandparent, as I happen to be. She may be interested in making some money because even though the executive officers in the state of Illinois get paid better than most Illinoisans, it doesn't compare to what a top-notch lawyer can make in a private firm. Or it could be that she's not looking forward to what would be a horribly nasty, vitriolic, mudslinging, negative, repulsive campaign, which the Republicans, through Bruce Rauner and his allies' money, are going to run against all Democrats, targeting her father, as we've said on the show before, the worst thing since her combination of Darth Vader and Lord Voldemort. And to make clear, the Democrats are going to do the exact same thing. They're going to try and paint people as being puppets of Bruce Rauner and the plutocrats. So it's just going to be just a lousy campaign. And if any public policy issues get discussed, or the record of the Attorney General in terms of consumer protection, environmental protection, that'll be kind of accidental along the way. And she maybe just didn't have the stomach to go through that garbage.
Well, Bernie, let's go back to the people who have announced so far. It's only been Scott Drury and Kwame Raoul on the Democratic side, Erica Harold on the Republican side. You're expecting more people are going to jump into this?
Remains to be seen, and Rick might know more. It's a very tempting thing because when you have someone named Madigan who has maintained her popularity despite who her father is, you know, Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan, who is also chairman of the Democratic Party, people who are attorneys and who want to move up from the legislature or other elective office, it's just been a difficult thing to see because you can't take on the incumbent of your party. And for Republicans, it's been taking on a Madigan, you really have to have your life in order and be willing to make that sacrifice of a year and a half of, as Charlie said, horrible campaigning and still have a life. And I think Erica Harold fits that because she is an established attorney and, you know, has her own national reputation based on the Miss America thing.
Scott Drury announced, or he talked about the timing of this, that he felt it was orchestrated in some way to prevent many people from jumping into this race that only possibly the Democratic Party establishment's chosen person would get in. Rick, you think there's any truth to that?
I think, frankly, this took everybody by surprise. And from what I've been hearing, that while the Speaker might have known it was coming, it wasn't with great advanced knowledge here. So, I mean, look, you need 10,000 valid signatures. You only need 5,000, but you file 10,000 valid signatures statewide to get on the ballot. And if you have any kind of an organization, that shouldn't be that difficult. But it is going to take a lot of money because you're assuming here that Bruce Rauner and through the state GOP, they're going to be funding Erica Harold. But you're going to need money to get through the primary, too. And I expect that there will be still more candidates coming out just because it's such a rare break in kind of the order of the Democratic ballot. And I still think there's some names out there. You mentioned Bernie Elaine Nekritz. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible she gets in. But I really think the idea that this was orchestrated somehow, it could be Scott Drury's former running mate, his former campaign manager, who's 26, telling him that was a good idea to say that.
I'd just like to, you know, Scott Drury has, I guess it's fair to say his campaign for governor didn't exactly get a lot of traction, but his key point was, I'm taking on Mike Madigan. I was the one member of the House on the Democratic side who did not vote for him for Speaker. So he has, let's see, in the terminology of campaigns, thrown lots of arrows at the party of which he is a part. So it doesn't divert very much from his modus operandi to say, oh, the party's doing all this stuff.
Also hear he's a former federal prosecutor.
It's a thing he apparently likes to say from time to time during conversations.
And that's one of the real popular misconceptions about the Attorney General, that the Attorney General should be out there investigating criminal activity. That's not the role of the Attorney General. The Constitution and the executive article actually says the Attorney General shall be the legal officer of the state and shall have the duties and powers that may be prescribed by law. And usually, going back 50 or more years, attorney generals have concentrated on consumer fraud, environmental protection. Lisa Madigan was involved in trying to shut down meth production in Illinois. She was involved in going after the student debt loan servicers who were cheating students and guiding them into more costly repayment arrangements than what were available under federal law. So she's got a really a long record of doing the kind of things that attorneys general always have done. And the one time she got the most attention when she tried to get involved in looking into wrongdoing, criminal wrongdoing, was back when she was looking at some of the Blagojevich administration hiring practices, and the U.S. attorney, in essence, told her to back off because he was in there and he didn't want her to mess up his investigation.
None of this, of course, stops any attorney general candidate from saying they're going to be tough on crime because that sells well. And I remember, and you know, one time years ago, somebody had the slogan, less attorney, more general. it didn't work.
Yeah, but
it didn't work, but it was an idea.
The criminal stuff is left up to the state's attorneys in the 102 counties of Illinois and the federal prosecutors in the three districts in Illinois.
Sean Crawford moderated the Illinois Politics Roundtable composed of Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, the State Journal Register's Bernie Schoenberg, and Rick Pearson, political writer for the Chicago Tribune. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The fight for a $15 minimum wage in Illinois hit a roadblock last month after Governor Bruce Rauner vetoed the bill that would make it happen. IPR's Dana Vollmer has more on this evergreen debate between business and labor.
The Illinois General Assembly approved a plan in late May that would gradually raise the minimum wage from $8.25 to $15 an hour over the next 5 years. But after 2 months on the governor's desk, Senate Bill 81 was shot down. The substantial raise proposal remains polarizing. Rob Carr is president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. He says the economy has moved beyond the current minimum wage, but not to $15 an hour.
As you see, particularly in the city of Chicago, Seattle, other places that have taken these steps where they're seeing employment lagging, they're seeing economic development lagging, they're seeing record unemployment continue to plague particularly underdeveloped neighborhoods.
Carr says proponents of a substantial minimum wage increase often point to the salary of a company's CEO as a culprit for impoverished lower-rank employees.
Let's assume we paid the CEO of McDonald's nothing, zero, next year, and gave it to all the workers. They'd make an extra $4.16 next year. Not an hour for the year. The math just doesn't work.
But David Cooper, senior analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, says there are several ways for businesses to offset the cost of a wage increase. Cooper says that when wages are higher, employee turnover rates go down. That saves money on recruitment and training costs. Higher wages often result in a boost in productivity, he says. And these same workers are the most likely consumers to go out and spend, driving more business activity. And if that's not enough,
because labor, and in particular low-wage labor, is just one portion of businesses' overall operating costs, most businesses are able to absorb those additional labor costs with very modest price increases.
Cooper says some studies have found a minimum wage increase of 10% could be offset by a 0.6% increase in menu prices at fast food restaurants. But fast food workers are only a portion of the lower-wage labor pool. State Representative Will Gazzardi, a Chicago Democrat, is the lead sponsor of the bill. He says the current minimum wage is offensive to people who work hard in jobs where they struggle to even get full-time status.
We're talking about people who are cleaning the buildings in which we live and work. We're talking about people who are preparing food for us. We're talking about people who are caring for our senior citizens and people with chronic disabilities. I mean, people who are doing incredibly difficult and incredibly important jobs.
Gazzardi says lawmakers settled on $15 an hour because that's the minimum required to lift working-class people out of poverty. He says anything lower is not sufficient to get by. Gazzardi attributes Rauner's resistance to the bill to his billionaire status.
This is someone who simply doesn't understand what it's like to have to decide whether you're going to pay the light bill or the heat this month. This is someone who doesn't understand what it's like to have to send your kid to school without the school supplies they need so you can afford to put food on the table that night. The kinds of decisions that millions of Illinoisans have to make every single day, they just simply don't register for Governor Rauner.
Rauner said in a statement after the veto that he rejected the bill because of the impact it would have on employers.
IPR's Dana Vollmer. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Martin's Home Furniture, featuring FlexSteel brand sofas, love seats, sectionals, and recliners, both leather and upholstery, built to be comfortable and built to last. Complimentary local delivery always available at Martin's Home Furniture in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
The past few months have been full of political news, and this station has been there every day with the latest updates. But we've also brought you news from way outside of Washington.
Mount Erebus towers over the Antarctic landscape.
Today we go on a hunt in an ancient forest in Southeast Asia.
Today we go to Tucson, Arizona, 70 miles from Mexico.
You turn to this station for the news of the day and something a little different. And this station turns to you for financial support. Become a new member today. And thanks.
Please contribute now at WGLT.org.
If you're new to this whole public radio thing, listen up. The in-depth news and quality entertainment you find on GLT and NPR depends on financial support from listeners just like you. The fact is, if you listen to GLT, you need to contribute to GLT. Make your first-time contribution now at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Local members of Habitat for Humanity are putting down their hammers and picking up a pair of dice in order to build more homes. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of the GLT Datebook.
Habitat for Humanity of McLean County is holding two fundraisers next month. There's the Blueprint Breakfast. Habitat for Humanity Development Director Noelle Lucerno says that's October 12th at the DoubleTree Hotel and Conference Center in Bloomington. It starts at 7 a.m. And coming up on October 5th at 5:30 p.m. at Eastland Suites, it's the Women Build Bunko Blitz. Women Build Chair Anna Ziegler says Women Build is a special program of Habitat for Humanity.
It's all about giving women the opportunity to be involved in the construction and contribute to alleviating poverty housing in our community.
So what's the attraction to being a part of Habitat for Humanity?
I think it's just a really powerful mission. We have been helping about six families a year, sometimes more, since we started in 1985. It really transforms the families' lives. They work alongside volunteers and staff to build their own home. They build on other Habitat families' homes. So there's literally blood, sweat, and tears that go into the process. And once it's all said and done, they have something that they can keep in their family forever if they wish. And it's a great way to give stability to families. It also revitalizes the neighborhoods that the homes are in. So I think being a part of that process is really powerful.
So you, of course, in order to build, there has to be money to pay for the supplies and that sort of thing. So you have fundraisers. The Women Build Bunko Blitz, October 5th at Eastland Suites. Sounds like a lot of fun, but what is Bunko?
Bunko is a fun and easy dice game. It's really simple. If you know how to roll dice, you can play, so no prior experience necessary. So we'll teach you that evening. We'll play about two rounds of Bunko. It's a team or a group game, so you play in a pair of two people in a group of four within a pod of 12. And then we'll have some prizes for those that do well.
Ah, so what are the prizes?
There's a cash prize for the most wins, and then there'll be T-shirts for the most losses. And we have a company that's donated mums as centerpieces. So the person who gets the most Bunkos will get to take the mum home.
How much do you hope to raise with the Bunko Blitz?
Our goal's between $4,000 and $5,000. We've got a great deal of donations for a silent auction. We've got some fabulous prizes. We're really pleased with the way that the community supported this event. And we'll also have various activities happening throughout the evening. We'll highlight some of the building that's going on in the community, our partner family this year. Actually, each one of the tables or sets of tables will be named after a family that Women Build has built for during the past 15 years. And we'll have pictures and things like that, as well as a table where people can find out more about Women Build and how to get involved.
Noelle, do you find that the Bloomington-Normal community and McLean County in general tend to be very generous when it comes to Habitat?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Very supportive. We have a ton of partners in the community, lots of churches, lots of businesses and civic organizations. In addition to Women Build, we also have a collegiate chapter. So ISU and Wesleyan have a joint Habitat chapter. And
I think that's one of the most successful collegiate ones in the country, if I'm not mistaken.
They've won awards before. They're in their 24th on their 24th house this year.
Well, you have another event coming up in October as well. You guys are going to be very busy in October. The Blueprint Breakfast is October 12th at the Doubletree Hotel and Conference Center, and that has an early start, so folks need to set their alarm.
That's
the doors
right.
open at 7 a.m. Tell me about this event.
7 a.m., but we will feed you. So you do get a breakfast that's free to attend, but this is our annual fundraiser, our annual appeal. We hope to have about 300 folks come, and so we could tell you about Habitat, you know, especially if you're kind of new to Habitat and maybe want to learn more. We'll have some families there telling their story and also educating people a little more about Restore and how that fits into Habitat for Humanity. Through this event, we hope to build 1 to 2 homes.
Anna, can you tell me why you're attracted to Habitat for Humanity? Why are you involved in Women Build?
I think it's a great opportunity to be involved in the community at a very grassroots level. You're actually building, physically building a house that a family gets to enjoy and contributing to building your community, quite literally. So I think it's a great opportunity to be involved and also to connect with people from all walks of life. That's another positive aspect.
That's Anna Ziegler, chair of Women Build, and Noelle Lucerno, Habitat for Humanity of McLean County's development director. The Women Build Bunko Blitz is October 5th at 5:30 p.m. at Eastland Suites. And the Blueprint Breakfast is October the 12th at 7 a.m. at the Doubletree. You can sign up for these events at HabitatMcLean.org. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Volunteer opportunities abound at Habitat for Humanity. If you're not so handy with a hammer, you can still help out by providing lunches and baked goodies for the work crews. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Members of a unique band based in Poland came to the United States for the first time earlier this month. As IPR's Rachel Otwell reports, their first destination was Springfield.
This video on YouTube has over 2 million views and features the musical stylings of Laboratorium Pieszczny, which translates to Sound Laboratory. The music is mostly a cappella, and part of what makes it special is how the voices of several females intermingle using a style called polyphonic singing. At times, drums and other percussion is also used. All the music draws from traditional songs from around the world, mainly Eastern Europe. Founders of the group recently came to Springfield to lead workshops on singing and to perform what's called a sound bath. Alina Yortishin and Camilla B. Goose performed the sound bath concert at a dance studio. Dozens of people were spread out on yoga mats and blankets, allowing the music to wash over them. Yortishin explains.
People are laying down on the ground in a very peaceful mode, yeah? Camilla is playing the violin, I'm playing the drum or shruti box, and we are singing traditional songs. Of course, we add many intuitive sounds, we add some improvisations.
Afterward, many talk about how relaxed they feel.
Their belief that music and harmony is healing, when you're laying there, you just feel better. That's all there is to it.
That's Terry Woodliffe, the woman who brought the two to town. She helped organize their first U.S. tour, which also includes stops in New Orleans, Seattle, and Dallas. Woodliffe lives in Texas now, but she used to call Springfield home. She says the area has a strong spiritual community, and she knew there would be interest in getting the girls here.
It is just a hotbed of energetic activity. You have shamanic breath work that goes on here regularly. You have pagan groups that meet to try and celebrate the seasons and bring good energy to people all around them.
Yortishin says she came upon this style of music by accident. She was working in a theater program when she started learning some traditional songs.
From the first moment, it touched my heart so deeply that I thought, oh my gosh, what is the secret of that kind of music? What is the mystery of it?
She calls the music she performs folk because she and the other ladies put their own unique spin on the tunes. It's taken off, and the band and its members have been traveling the world. Yortishin and B. Goose go to cities where they perform the sound baths as a duo and lead workshops, helping others learn to sing the way they do. That's the sound of 40 people singing after two intensive days learning three songs. The workshop sold out months ago and took place at a spiritual retreat in Springfield, a place run by Catholic nuns that's called Jubilee Farm. Your Titian emphasizes the importance of being open to new possibilities and says that everyone can sing, as she tells the attendees before they part ways and head home.
Really, it's the biggest lie in our civilization that we need a school to sing. It's the biggest lie that we need a school for dancing, a school for breathing. It's the biggest lie. Look at children, yeah? They know how to sing, they know how to dance, they know how to breathe.
Some people have traveled all the way from the East Coast for the workshops here. Łucja Lanaczek is originally from the same city in Poland as Laboratorium Pieśni. She says she had previously been too afraid to sing in front of others. She now lives in Chicago and helped plan another sound bath that took place there. She talks about what she's learned so far.
To sing well is to sing with your own voice, opening yourself up to that therapeutic level of truly finding your voice, your authentic voice, and singing with that is when you feel the power that you hold within.
And as it turns out, it sounds pretty amazing when people come together and use their authentic voice to meet within a song, as the organizers describe it. Your Titian says while she's not sure what she is helping others connect with through music, it's something spiritual and it's bigger than herself. I'm Rachel Otwell.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the stories and interviews you heard today thanks to Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Charlie Schlenker at our website, WGLT.org. That's also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org.